everyone. Dan Dilbin here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Thank you for tuning in to 101.5. We here in Huntley strive to entertain you. And we want, in addition to that, we want to inform you. And if you're not careful, we might even amuse you once in a while. Well, today's program begins with a fairly long set of comments about travel today and the way travel is changing and different places that are changing to accommodate the new world. Well, this will be a series of comments in not only in this program where I introduce it, but it will occur from program to program from now on for probably a month or two as I talk about different places. Global travel is more possible now than it was in the last 2 years. But it remains difficult and certainly fraught with uncertainty. And beyond the pandemic, there is the profound shift underway in the world's understanding of climate change and the swiftness and degree to which we are already seeing its effects. Wildfires and floods, dangerous storms, and rising water levels and temperatures. These remind us how fragile our world really is. The travel industry is responsible for 8 to 11% of total greenhouse gas emissions. This according to the World Travel and Tourism Council. And at the Glasgow Climate Summit meeting last fall, the tourism industry made its first commitment to cut carbon emissions by half by 2030, and to reach net zero by 2050. There is also the problem of overtourism, which has been held in check by the pandemic, but threatens to reassert itself as the world once again starts to move around from one place to another. The crowds that have made Venice all but impassable in the high season, or turned neighborhoods in Barcelona into Airbnb outposts, have now thinned a bit. But will we have learned anything from the forced shutdown that we've had? Or will the same patterns reemerge? Yet travel can also be a part of the solution, and not only on climate. Travel supports depleted economies in places that depend on tourist dollars and exposes travelers to cultures and customs that are different from their own. That thought is the animating spirit behind this list of places that I'll be talking about over the next few months. There are some 30 places for a changed world, which have been mentioned by an extremely long article in the New York Times this past weekend, but we'll get to those later on. In the past, the New York Times has published an annual destinations list that often focused on things like a hot restaurant scene, an exciting new museum, or the opening of a fabulous beachfront resort. But the list that I'll be drawing from instead highlights places where change is happening, where endangered wildlands are being preserved, threatened species are being protected, historical wrongs are being acknowledged, fragile communities are being bolstered, and where travelers can be part of the change. This is not the spinach of travel lists. Diving with sharks in the Caribbean is magical, but it's even more so when you know that you are helping to save those creatures that are so critical to the ocean's health. Touring Normandy's moody coast in the northwest of France, touring on a bike is delightful, and the carbon saved is a bonus. Some of the places that we'll be talking about may not be open to travelers just yet, and some are in areas hard hit by the virus that may not be completely safe just yet. But our message is not to hop on the next plane, but to use the list and the identification of places as inspiration for your own more purposeful, more fulfilling travel exploits in the reasonably near future. And along with that, I came across these comments about travel that you might appreciate. One is about North Carolina's glow-in-the-dark mine. That's right, glowing in the dark. When Alan Chabillion and his wife first brought black lights into the Bon Ami mine after nightfall, what they saw was out of this world, according to an article in Smithsonian magazine. The mine in North Carolina's Blue Ridge Mountains had once been tapped for the feldspar used in Bon Ami cleanser. But its towering walls and ceilings are encrusted with hyalite, a type of opal. And though hyalite is a colorless glass-like crystal, when it's exposed to ultraviolet light, it glows a brilliant fluorescent green and immediately calls to mind the kryptonite from the Superman comic book. And then there's this item, Seeing Alaska by Bush Plane. Flying in a Bush mail plane in central Alaska feels like an experience out of another era, according to an article in the Boston Globe. A small company in Fairbanks, Alaska, called War Billows Air Ventures, delivers mail, food, and other essentials to seven towns within a 110-mile radius. You'll be likely to ride with local legend Matt Anderson if you go on this bush plane. He's been a pilot for 40-plus years. The drone of the plane's twin engines will make talking a struggle. So you'll mostly keep your noses pressed against the glass to see the landscape of snowy mountain tops, frozen rivers, and forests of spruce and green. Something to think about. We'd like to go there on your next vacation and truly rough it. Well, I'll be right back in a minute or two. Don't go away. Listen to this nice music to entertain you. We're back again, and it's raining. No, not here in the studio, but it's rain is the topic of our information segment about wild weather. If you've been listening to the program over the last few weeks, you'll know that I've been talking about different kinds of weather. And I wanted to continue on to talk a bit more about rain as I began last program. Langston Hughes, the poet, said, "Let the rain kiss you. Let the rain beat upon your head with silver liquid drops. Let the rain sing you a lullaby." And so we're going to look at different rainfall types and explain rain a bit more than we did last time. The sun is the alchemist afoot here. Seeks out moisture from the earth. It steals from plants and leaves, oceans and lakes and rivers, and transforms it into vapor that swiftly rises. Once in the sky, the vapor becomes droplets as a result of condensation around impurities that are called condensation nuclei. And eventually, the water returns to Earth as rain and becomes part of the hydrologic cycle, which is a continual and life-giving process. Now, when water falls from the sky to the ground, we call it precipitation. But while you might think that rain is simply rain, there are different types of rain, or rainfall, which is brought about by different situations. For example, relief rainfall comes from the sea as the air rises over higher ground. And as the air mass rises, it cools and condenses. Eventually, with rain falling. This is the kind of rainfall that climatologists, geographers refer to as orographic rainfall. Orographic rainfall is important in a number of places around the world, supplying the greatest amount of rainfall during the year. And then there's frontal rainfall, which occurs along weather fronts. You probably watch the weather forecast on the TV stations, your favorite weather forecast, whether it's Tom Skilling, WGN in Chicago, or someone else. So you're a bit familiar with the term. Frontal rain. That is, we're talking about again, what climatologists, geographers, and meteorologists refer to as cyclonic rainfall, a cyclonic system with a low pressure area which moves through the atmosphere. And from it extends a warm front and a cold front. And this is because there are different kinds of air masses on either side of the front. Well, both of those weather fronts have a slope to them. Usually the cold front has a much steeper one. And the warm front is a more gentle one, if you can picture that. And as air with moisture in it moves up over the fronts, whether the warm front or caused to rise by the cold front, why precipitation occurs. You know, the air is moist, it's lifted, it reaches what's called the condensation level, where the air becomes saturated and moisture turns to rain, the rain falling in to the surface. So a warm front and a cold front both can be producers of rainfall. Oftentimes, the warm frontal rain will be perhaps of a more gentle nature, whereas the cold frontal rain we often identify with thunderstorms and more severe weather. But you see, this is just another type of rainfall, and it's the process of lifting the air with which it is identified. And then I've talked about the warm front and the cold front extending out from the low pressure center. Well, between those two fronts, there is an area where the warmer air is located. And it's that area, which is called the warm sector of a cyclone, where convectional rain will take place, which usually occurs as the ground is heated, the hot air rises swiftly, sometimes so fast that it cools and condenses and causes what we call air mass thunderstorms. So you have orographic rainfall, you have frontal rainfall, and you have air mass rainfall. And then there's still a different type that I wanted to mention. And that is, so often when it's raining heavily, sometimes in buckets, as we say, it's a monsoon out there. Well, what is a monsoon? A monsoon is a seasonal wind shift with respect to the land and the water offshore, usually a large body of water, like a very large lake, like Lake Michigan, or the ocean, like the Pacific, or Arabian Sea, or the Bay of Bengal in Southern Asia. In any event, the wind changes direction. And you've often heard when you've listened to the weather forecast about the lake breeze with respect to Chicago's weather. As the land heats up, air rises and air flows in from the lake to take its place. And then when the condition is reversed, the air flows out from the land over the body of water. So a monsoon, usually though, occurs on a larger scale. One scale of, say, the southwestern United States. I'll come back to that in a moment. And the land masses and nearby water bodies in southern and southeast Asia. You hear a lot about the monsoon in India, for example, in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. But we also have a monsoon in our southwest, in Arizona, for example. You say, well, that's a desert. It's dry there. This isn't a monsoon area. Well, it is. At certain times of the year, when there is a flow of air into the area off of the Pacific, and rainfall is associated with the higher areas, the mountainous areas in the southwestern part of our country in Arizona. And so there is a perceptible shift in wind direction, even there. But you don't often hear about it if you live in this part of the country, here in the Midwest. And so those are the different types of rainfall that we can have. And then, with that in mind, did you know that the small town of Unionville in Maryland holds the world's record for the highest amount of rainfall received over 1 minute? This took place in 1956 during a powerful storm, and one onlooker reported that the town received more than an inch and almost an inch and three quarters in a minute. This was confirmed by the U.S. Weather Bureau. The island of La Réunion claims the title of the highest amount of rainfall in the world during a 12 and 24 hour period. According to the Guinness Book of World Records, 71 inches of rain fell during the 24 hours between January the 7th and January the 8th in 1966. It fell on the community of Fault. It's a French speaking community. So it's FOC-FOC, Fault. And the record breaker for the amount of rainfall during a year is in northeastern India, in the area of Assam. And there is a village that receives 467 inches of rain on an average year. So there you get the monsoon effect, which is associated with the Himalaya Mountains and the foothills of the Himalayas. They're the culprits. Be back in a minute or two. Oh, back again for a few words before we have to sign off for today. I wanted to tell you about what we're going to be talking about for probably parts of several programs in the future, probably the next program and the one after it. And the topic is brain health, the basics of brain health. Keeping an eye on your overall health is key for brain health, but it may be especially important to prevent certain medical issues. You want to watch these numbers before I can talk about this in more detail. Monitoring and managing your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and your blood sugar levels are essential for optimum brain function. And then check your hearing. Get good sleep. But there are some things that are hard on your brain, some things that you should, if this applies to you, you should reconsider your lifestyle, perhaps. Smoking, junk food, too much alcohol, and air pollution. Those are all working against a better condition for your brain. During the programs in the next week or two, as I talk about brain health, we'll cover diet and lifestyle and I hope that this is something that will be of useful information for you. But in the meantime, I want you to stay healthy, be safe, be kind to each other, as I always say, because you'll surprise people by your kindness. And I certainly appreciate you tuning in to 101.5 on your FM dial today to listen to a little of this, a little of that. We strive to inform you, entertain you, once in a while to amuse you. So it's time for Willie Nelson, my close friend, who goes with me down the road as we look for those bits of information that fits so well into a little of this, a little of that. You can never depend on just one or two things. There'll be a mixture, a potpourri of different items. So, as they would say in the South, y'all come back now here. We're waiting for you. We'd like to have you around. Willie, take us down the road. Take us home.